evening. This is Peter Hammond in the studio for From the Frontline. In South Africa, we are facing a whole interesting series of amazing events that are coming one on top of the other. We've recently seen the president change. We've seen a lot of dramatic changes, political maneuvering within the ANC, and change of president in South Africa within just a day of the resignation of the one president. We next had the State of the Nation address, actually the same speech with virtually no major changes, quickly adapted for the new president. How are we to understand the times? How are we to respond to the challenges before us? And what has been going on behind the scenes and under the surface? What are the realities which most media reports are ignoring? It is vital that we understand the times and we know what God's people should do. Well, first and foremost, I don't think many people fully understand what was going on in this country over the last years. One thing that may interest people is how both Jacob Zuma and Thabo Mbeki were handpicked as successors by Nelson Mandela. When Nelson Mandela became president in 1994, he first made Thabo Mbeki and F.W. de Klerk as two vice presidents, South Africa's two vice presidents, and then later on chose Jacob Zuma to be his second deputy president. So plainly, Nelson Mandela wanted to set up both Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma as his successors. This is interesting because many people want to say that, well, Nelson Mandela was great, but his successors have been terrible. In fact, his successors were exactly what he chose, and he did lay the foundations for it. It's important to realize that in South Africa, quite alternative to the way it's been presented, many people have tried to suggest that the ANC won the war and they were gracious and merciful to the defeated enemies. But in fact, the reverse is true. There can be no doubt that the South African Defence Force won the war. As a military force, the African National Congress's Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK, was a failure. So too was the Pan-African Congress's PAC, UPLA. Yes, they managed some high-profile terrorist attacks, such as the Church Street bombing in Pretoria, the St. James Massacre in Cape Town, but they were never able to defeat the South African Defence Force in battle. In fact, they could only operate as terrorist movements, planting landmines, limpet mines, suitcase bombs, car bombs, engaging in necklace murders and assassinations of black town councillors and black mayors and elected black representatives. And every time the South African Defence Force attacked, the guerrillas or freedom fighters or terrorists, as you may want to call them, were defeated and the survivors fled. That was also true for SWAPO in Southwest Africa, Namibia and Angola. And in the 26-year war in Southwest Africa, Namibia, SWAPO managed to murder about 10,000 civilians, much of them by landmines. However, they were never able to hold any ground in Southwest Africa and even external bases in Angola, protected by Cuban, Soviet, Angolan, MPLA, FAPLA forces, were destroyed whenever the South African Defence Force attacked. At the height of the Cold War, from 1985 to 1988, the South African Defence Force faced increasing confrontations with Soviet MiG fighter bomber jets, not only the MiG-21s, but the MiG-23s, and the Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunships, massive ground offensives by Cuban mechanized divisions, including Castro's Presidential Guard Division. On every occasion, the South African Defence Force decisively defeated the Cuban and Soviet forces in Angola. General Jannie Heldenhuys, in his book We Were There, Winning the War for Southern Africa, documents the enormous Soviet mobilization in Angola and the staggering losses they endured at the hands of the SADF. And he quotes from Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Igor Zandarkin, who was a participant in the Angolan War. Zandarkin's book, We Did Not See It, Even in Afghanistan, published by the Russian Academy of Science Institute for African Studies, attributes the fall of the Soviet Union to the ripple effects of the disastrous defeat suffered by the Russians and their Cuban allies in Angola at the hands of the South African Defence Force and our UNITA allies. He also quotes from Joe Malhazy's book, Angola, The Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. José Malhazy is of Portuguese origin and based in Russia, and his first book's title was The End of the Soviet Union. The second, Angola, The Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. Carlos Macheco, a Brazilian historian who wrote the preface to Mohazi's book, The Fracas of Soviet Expansionism, concludes, "The first priority of the Russian expansionism in southern Africa was not so much important in terms of minerals, but above all about politics." He emphasized that it was the Republic of South Africa that the Soviets had their sights on. Angola was only a stepping stone towards a mineral-rich and the strategic South Africa, especially in terms of the Cape Sea route. Chester Crocker, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, in his book High Noon in Southern Africa, Making Peace in a Rough Neighborhood, reported, "In early October 1987, the Soviet FAPLA offensive was smashed at the Lomba River near Mavinga. It turned into a headlong retreat over the 120 miles back to the primary launching point at Quito Carnaval. In some of the bloodiest battles of the entire Civil War, a combined force of some 8,000 UNITA fighters and 4,000 South African Defense Force troops destroyed a FAPLA, that's the MPLA, Angolan Communist Brigade, and hauled several others out of a total FAPLA force of some 18,000 engaged in a three-pronged offensive. Estimates of FAPLA losses ranged upwards of 4,000 killed and wounded. This offensive had been a Soviet conception from start to finish, and senior Soviet officers played a central role in its execution. Over 1,000 Soviet-Russian advisors were assigned to Angola in 1987 to help with Moscow's largest logistical effort to date in Angola. Roughly $1.5 billion in military hardware was delivered just that year. Huge quantities of Soviet equipment were destroyed or fell into UNITA and the South African Defense Force hands when the Cubans and FAPLA broke into disorganized retreat. The 1987 military campaign represented a stunning humiliation for the Soviet Union, its arms, and its strategy." At one hostile press conference in Windhoek, Colonel Dion Ferreira, the operational commander of Operations Modulo, Hooper, and Packer, was challenged to respond to accusations that the South Africans had actually been beaten in the just-concluded battles in Angola. He responded tongue-in-cheek, "If defeat for South Africa meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armored vehicles, and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for the FAPLA and Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armored vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at over R1 billion, then they won. Facts are stubborn things, such as the fact that the supreme commander for the communists in Angola, Cuban General Arnulfo Ocar Sanchez, was executed by firing squad less than a year later in Havana, Cuba, for the crime of having lost to the lackeys of the running dog, the fascist, racist South Africans, etc., etc. Now, I've walked in these graveyards of Soviet tanks and armored cars and shot out equipment in Angola, and I have many pictures of shot down Soviet aircraft, destroyed Soviet and Cuban tanks in Angola. There's no doubt about who won the war in Angola. The dismantled Soviet Union, the dismantled Iron Curtain, the dismantled Berlin Wall also makes clear who lost the Cold War. And when I had an opportunity to speak to F.W. de Klerk, the previous president of South Africa, I asked him if he had seen the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom film and what he thought of how the process, the negotiation process, was depicted. He smiled and said no, he hadn't seen the film, and he had no intention of seeing it, and he assured that it would not depict the negotiation process accurately, based as it was on Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. I then asked the previous president, Mr. de Klerk, if he could correct my perception if I was wrong. I said, "We are continually being bombarded with disinformation that the ANC won the war, and Mandela was gracious to his defeated enemies. I'd always thought that the opposite was true. We won the war, and our government chose to be gracious with our defeated enemies. My understanding is that after a series of stunning military victories in Angola, when we had thoroughly blunted and devastated the communist forces in Angola, with the Russians having withdrawn from Angola, with the Cubans being withdrawn, and the Berlin Wall falling and the Iron Curtain collapsing, as one country after another throughout Eastern Europe overthrew the communist dictators who had oppressed them for decades, our government in South Africa had chosen to seize the initiative and initiate negotiations with the ANC and other black nationalist groups to seek a peaceful resolution for South Africans. At this, Mr. de Klerk nodded very vigorously and agreed heartily, yes, it's true. That is true, he said. We negotiate from a position of strength. The ANC had lost their Soviet sponsors, and we saw an opportunity to seize the initiative and to resolve our problems in South Africa by bringing about a constitutional state where the rule of law would guarantee the rights of all. Mr. de Klerk then smiled and said, if we had wanted to, the National Party could still be the government of this country and I could still be its president. Then he added, however, that would have been at the cost of many more lives lost in an ongoing war. I replied that there were many South Africans, including myself, who would have gladly continued fighting against communism and terrorism, especially as vastly more died from crime since than had even died during the war. During the whole war, we lost less than 670 men, that's police and army, on the border in Southwest Africa and in Angola. And yet today, that's over a 26-year period of war. Yet today, we're losing 25,000 people a year being murdered in South Africa. And since Mandela became president, 85,000 whites have been murdered. And of those, 4,000 are farmers and their family members being tortured to death in the most gruesome ways in these farm murders. And de Klerk said, I know, but apartheid had to go. We could not fight for an unjust cause. My response was, Mr. de Klerk, my understanding is apartheid had already been rejected by a white South African electorate in the 1983 referendum. In fact, your predecessor, President P.W. Botha, had abolished virtually every apartheid law before 1989. We were not fighting for apartheid. We were fighting against communism and we were fighting against terrorism. That is true, said Mr. de Klerk. However, that is not the way the world saw it. Until they saw a black president over South Africa, they would not believe that apartheid was abolished. I then asked him, Mr. de Klerk, do you believe the ANC are being true to the agreement you negotiated with them back in 1994? No, he replied, they are not. We agreed to a constitutional state where the rule of law applies without any regard to race. And I then said, Mr. de Klerk, there are many who are looking to you to set the record straight and remind South Africans of the world what was negotiated and agreed on in 1994. And Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. It is impossible to understand recent South African history without understanding the Cold War and the very clear and present threat of Soviet expansionism and the Communist Revolution. That was the context. The defeat of the Soviet Union forces in Angola, in Afghanistan, in Nicaragua, and the tidal wave of opposition to communism that swept Eastern Europe in 1989, which brought an end to Soviet control of Eastern Europe and the collapse of the Soviet Union itself, opened up the way for ending the wars throughout Southern Africa and providing for elections in Namibia, Zambia, Angola, Mozambique, and South Africa. This resolved conflicts which had ranged throughout the Cold War. The Soviet Union and communism was behind all these conflicts, and once the Soviet threat was removed, all these countries managed to secure internal settlements. It was after the South African Defence Force's decisive military victories in the field that the National Party government decided, for better or for worse, not that I agreed with their decisions, but this is just the fact of history, it was after those decisive military victories that the National Party government of F.W. de Klerk decided to release Nelson Mandela and other ANC and South African Communist Party revolutionaries from prison in the hopes of bringing about negotiations that they hoped would end the violence and international isolation against South Africa. But that is quite the reverse of what the state media, school textbooks, and Hollywood would have us believe. Isaiah 5:20 says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Acquitting the guilty, condemning the innocent, the Lord detests them both. That's Proverbs 17:15. We've got to be so careful as we look at history that we understand what is going on. So propaganda changes perceptions and it changes people. And what we are seeing today is a lot of promotion of racism and intolerance and hatred in the name of combating racism and intolerance. I saw this at a Department of Justice and Constitutional Development consultation on a national action plan to combat racism, discrimination, xenophobia, and intolerance. This is in March 2016. It sounded like a great idea. I thought about time that somebody in government was going to do something constructive against all these farm murders and all these irresponsible ANC politicians singing kill the Boer, kill the farmer, one settler, one bullet, and rabble-rousers wearing kill all whites t-shirts on college campuses. With all the talk about eradicating Afrikaans as a language and then mobs destroying art treasures and national monuments, this initiative to actually combat racism and intolerance and xenophobia and discrimination was obviously long overdue. However, it was not long after arriving at this Justice Department's conference center in Century City that I had the uncomfortable feeling that, like Alice in Wonderland, I had fallen through the looking glass and was at some kind of Mad Hatter's tea party. It was not just the opulent catering overflowing the tables. The speakers didn't seem to have read the memo. Unless my ears were deceiving me, speaker after speaker seemed to be promoting racism, discrimination, xenophobia, and intolerance. So I turned to the draft document for public consultation of the National Action Plan in this glossy Department of Justice publication. There it was, yes. Hate crimes, acts motivated by bias based on the identity with reference to race, religion, national origin of a victim, whose forms of bias motivated violence, hate crimes, are message crimes that send a message of fear to an entire community. Hate crimes, particularly when they do not meet an adequate response from the state, violate fundamental principles of equality and non-discrimination and can lead to social unrest. And there was the discrimination definition. Definition of discrimination imposes burdens, obligations, or advantages on, or withholds benefits from, opportunities or advantages from any person on one or more of the prohibited grounds. And institutional racism, definition given, any system of inequality based on race. Yet I was hearing speaker after speaker advocate what seemed to me racist hate speech, institutionalized intolerance, systematic discrimination against whites in general and Afrikaners in particular, who, let's face it, have become a minority in what used to be our own country. Not only were they not dealing with the thousands of farmers tortured to death in the most hideous manner in South Africa, but they were making the most outrageous generalizations and racist statements against the white minority, such as all whites are racist. We have to invade those sections where whites are still in charge. All whites have to be re-educated. The honeymoon period of democracy has come to an end. Equality is not enough. This is not a single issue revolution. No more reconciliation. The white culture must fall. Racial superiority is expressed through sports. Rugby is everything to the Afrikaner. If you want to really hurt the Afrikaner, you must crush their rugby. We must insist that at least 50% of all the rugby teams are black. Afrikaans is not a language for education. It has no place in universities. We need to deconstruct the systematic racism by eradicating whiteness. We have had over 21 years of carrots. Now we need the sticks. They must feel the pressure to compel them to hand over all the resources. The biggest failure of the TRC was the failure to address sports. We cannot allow the Constitution to get in the way of redistribution of all wealth and removing all whites from all positions of authority and land ownership. One speaker of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Tony Eirich, declared, racism is inculcated in every doctrine of Christianity. Christianity is racist. Nikhail Dipal, National Chairperson for Students for Law and Social Justice, declared, he used to believe in God until he saw inequality in the world. Then he realized God is the ultimate racist. Therefore, he had given up on religion because of inequality in the world. God is the ultimate racist. That's what they said. The absolute mindless, out of touch with reality, Marxist, atheistic hatred for Christianity from these speakers chosen by the Department of Justice was staggering. I looked back at the definitions at the beginning of the document, and sure enough, bias against any religion or against somebody's conscience constitutes hate speech. Yet here was a steady stream of speakers stereotyping all whites, all Christians, and all males in the most hostile and prejudicial language. There was evidently a blatant double standard and a blindness to their own hatred, racism, and their own malicious agenda. The fact is, only biblical Christianity offers a rational basis for opposing racism and for pursuing justice. Equality before the law is a biblical principle. Numbers 15:15, there shall be one law for you and the alien in your midst. It is a fact of history that the teachings and the example of Jesus Christ inspired the invention of hospitals, the nursing profession, history's greatest charitable movements like the International Red Cross, the abolition of the slave trade led by evangelical member of Parliament William Wilberforce, and missionaries like David Livingston, and much more. The teachings of Jesus Christ to love your neighbor, to do to others as you want them to do unto you, the Good Samaritan, and so much more have inspired the greatest acts of charity, compassion, and mercy ever seen in history. Whereas atheism and Marxism have a devastating legacy of death and destruction. And dare we say it, discrimination. Yet here we were seeing and hearing Marxist radicals hijacking this consultation, which is meant to oppose racism, hate speech, intolerance, to promote racism, hate speech, intolerance, and Marxist revolutionary objectives. Communists have been taught that they must create conflict, class warfare, race warfare, whatever is necessary, break down existing structures, break down all ties of blood, soil, family, nation, race, faith, provide fertile ground for revolution by breaking down all existing structures and restructuring all of life around the Communist Party, leading to a dictatorship of the proletariat. In his manifesto of 1848, Karl Marx wrote, "The theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence, abolition of private property. You reproach us with intending to do away with your property? Precisely so. That is just what we intend." And thereof quoted entirely from Karl Marx. Karl Marx also declared, "Without violence, nothing is ever accomplished in history." Karl Marx also wrote, "The abolition of religion is a requisite." In his Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx wrote, "Communism abolishes eternal truths. It abolishes all religion and all morality." Karl Marx, quote, "God is our enemy. Hatred of God is the beginning of wisdom," was echoed in these representatives' comments that God is the ultimate racist. Vladimir Lenin declared, "Atheism is the natural and inseparable part of communism. We must hate. Hatred is the basis of communism." Now, that quote would not have been out of place in a so-called consultation to combat racism, discrimination, xenophobia, and intolerance. It was evident that atheists were using this event, as they have been so many other events and university campuses and classrooms, as a pretext to advance an anti-Christian agenda. The gay GB Pink Inquisition was also evident, demonizing males and Christian families. It is quite clear that what we are having here is an attempt to bring about a revolution like we have seen in Zimbabwe, which led that country to complete and utter destruction. It is not possible to destroy racism with racism. You cannot build a better future by destroying the past. And continually, we are seeing people who have this attitude of hostility towards the males. Gillian Shooter, the co-founder of Media for Justice, ranted and raved against whiteness and that all whites are racist and need for all whites to be re-educated. She also rallied against patriarchy and made clear that not just white males were they against, but black patriarchy is also the enemy. And she spoke about the need for the second phase of the revolution. Evidently, many of the speakers at this consultation saw themselves as victims. So even after decades of ANC misrule, they're not willing to take responsibility for anything wrong in the country. Anything wrong is the fault of the whites and apartheid. Very convenient, but hardly constructive in improving the situation. And so according to several of the speakers, the solution was socialism, communist revolution, confiscation, radical feminist, gay GB, pink inquisition, deconstructing systematic racism, eradicating whiteness, advancing traditional jurisprudence. And inevitably, from all this will flow socialist utopia. We'll all live happily ever after, just like in Zimbabwe, Cuba, the Soviet Union, Vietnam, North Korea, and so on. Well, the trouble is, as 2 Peter 2:19 says, while they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of depravity. Which brings us back to where we are now. So we're at an interesting situation where Jacob Zuma has ended his 9 years of misrule, and he has been now replaced by Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, how did this come about? Well, the first thing that's very interesting is that when Jacob Zuma was deputy president under Thabo Mbeki, and that was his position from 1999 to 2005, he was the deputy president. And when there was a vast amount of something like 750 different charges of corruption and a rape charge and a whole lot of other things against him, he was fired from being deputy president. And the interesting thing is that this was organized by the Scorpions. The Scorpions were an FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, trained super anti-corruption task force, which the Americans had insisted upon back in 1994 at South Africa's Mandela elections, where, as a precondition to American foreign aid, they required that there would be a high-powered, FBI-trained counter-corruption force that would be answerable to no one but the president, so that they would be able to investigate even cabinet ministers and evidently deputy presidents. And this group was needed because even the African Union has admitted that corruption is the biggest single threat to everything in Africa, and development in particular, because according to the African Union, 25% of the gross domestic product, the total wealth of Africa, is stolen every year by governments. So government corruption accounts for 25% of the GDP of the total continent of Africa being stolen every year. That's not counting other thieves. That's just counting government corruption alone. And while Jacob Zuma said, concern about corruption is a white issue, he said, corruption doesn't hurt anyone. Well, we would disagree, because evidently corruption hurts everyone. The loss of corruption to Africa is 10 times greater than all the foreign aid combined. In other words, we wouldn't need foreign aid if we could just bring corruption down 10% in Africa. Imagine if you could bring it down 20%, or even halve it or eradicate altogether, just how wealthy Africa would be. But even according to the African Union, more than 40% of the total wealth of Africa is held offshore by Africans. So Africans are not even investing in our own continent because of the corruption. And therefore, having a deputy president so obviously involved in such a huge amount of corruption, it was obviously part of the job of the Scorpions to investigate this. Well, Jacob Zuma then did an incredible comeback by hijacking the ANC, the African National Congress's conference at Polokwane in 2007, and managed to get Mbeki ousted as head of the ANC. He was then elected head of the ANC, and bearing in mind that in South Africa you don't vote for your president, you vote for the party. The party chooses the president. This may confuse people in America in particular, because in the United States you vote for your president and you vote for your Congress separately. In South Africa you vote for the party. Nationally and provincially, you could actually have a vote for a different party provincially as you have nationally, but you've got two votes, one for the province, one which is like the state, and the other for the national elections. And as a result of that, the parties choose which candidates go where. And this goes to the point that the party chooses who's the town mayor, it chooses who's the premier or governor of the state, all the way through to who's the president. So by seizing control over the party, he was able to change the presidency, which is exactly what's happened now. So what he sowed back in 2007 has now been reaped by him in now 2018. So we've seen interesting time in the last 9 years where Jacob Zuma was able to bring down the president by seizing control of the party. Now the same party that he seized control of has been behind Cyril Ramaphosa's interesting coup, which has now replaced Zuma. Interesting that we can see a party having the power to change the president and the government. A bit disturbing that things are that centralized and that a party can actually trump what people have voted for on the ground. But that's because we have the so-called proportional representation system. Now, Jacob Zuma, of course, was corrupt. But people are then saying, we're now in a new dawn, new hope. Cyril Ramaphosa is going to bring everything around. And there's a lot of people who've got faith and hope in Cyril Ramaphosa. I should make a comment here about an anecdote of when I personally met with Cyril Ramaphosa. We were, in fact, regularly bringing submissions through in the name of Christian Action to the Parliament's Constitutional Assembly, which he was chairman of, in terms of everything from the right to life and the health portfolio, against the secular state, against pornography, on publications issues, and so on many different issues, education, gun control, the right to keep and bear arms, and so on. So we had a lot of interaction at that time with the very committees that Cyril Ramaphosa was coordinating. And at one point, I led a march of 30,000 people to the gates of Parliament, and this was in May 1995. And apparently, it's the largest march ever seen in Cape Town to that date. And the ANC inside the Parliament were absolutely terrified. We heard from Kenneth Meshew, who was inside Parliament at the time, how the ANC was panic-stricken and thought that their days were up, and they pushed Cyril Ramaphosa out. Now, he was not the head. He wasn't Mandela. He wasn't Thabo Mbeki as deputy president, but he was the Constitutional Assembly chairman. So they pushed him out. And he was the one who had to come and receive our memorandum. And you could see his eyes were wide. He was sweating, even though it was May in our winter. It was not a hot day. But he was plainly nervous as he came to us to receive our memorandum. And as he approached me, he saw next to me my Zulu friend, co-worker, Reverend Fana Sabisi, holding a big black leather Bible, gilt-edged, thumb indexed with his name, actually, Rev. Fano Sabisi, engraved in gold on the cover. It was a gift from my father-in-law from Phoenix, Arizona. And Cyril Ramaphosa looked at Fano and said, "Brother, can I borrow your Bible?" And without waiting for a reply, he seized the Bible out of his hands and strode up the stairs onto the platform that we were using at Parliament, outside Gates of Parliament. Actually, it was the back of a bucky, was our platform there, and on the back of this large pickup truck, he lifted the Bible above his head and he shouted out to the crowd, "I am also a Christian. Look, I bring my Bible to Parliament with me every day." And he was lifting up Fana Sabisi's Bible, and Fana and I looked at one another in shock. And we looked up, and if I'd had a camera in my hand, I could have got a picture of Cyril Ramaphosa holding this black Bible, this gilt-edged Bible of Fana Sabisi, with Fana's name plainly visible at the distance we were standing. We were that close. If I had had a camera in my hands, I could have got a picture of that. But here was this man, a suave, slick politician, able to lie so quickly, so smoothly, and while he knew that those of us at the bottom of the stairs would have immediately recognized he had lied, he knew that the bulk of the masses there would not know, and apparently he didn't care that some of us knew he had just lied so blatantly like that. Well, that's a bit of background. I've seen a lot of people reporting on Cyril Ramaphosa as a businessman and even a successful businessman. And, well, he's not a businessman in a normal sense. You see, according to the rules of the Constitution he helped author and craft and put together, companies in the country who want government contracts and so on need to hand over vast amounts of their shares and control to black men, businessmen like himself. And he was in the front of the queue, evidently, because he became a billionaire. According to reports, at the moment he is worth well over 6 billion rand, which is over $550 million, as of 2017, with 31 properties, with major ownership in companies such as McDonald's, South Africa, on the board and chairman for MTN, a major cell phone company, and on the board for Lonmin Mines and a lot of other things like that too. And he's had questionable involvement in a whole range of things, such as where miners have their pay packages and everything handled by his personal consultancy company on behalf of the mines. And miners were even killed, a large number of them, in the Marikana mine massacre, which was directly because they were wanting more salary. In fact, the mines were providing much more than what they were asking. The miners were earning something in under 5,000 rand, but they were being allocated more than 10,000 rand a month each. And the company that Cyril Ramaphosa was part of, which is providing a personnel consultancy work for the mine, were pocketing more than half of the salaries for themselves and operating expenses, more than half. And so I think the miners were asking for something in the region of 7,000 rand a month instead of the 4,800 odd or whatever it was, something along that line, speaking from memory. And they were already being allocated, but instead of negotiating with them, the police were mobilized and effectively shot something like 30 odd of these miners in the Marikana mine massacre, which has been described as the ANC sharpful. And he's been a key part of this. So Cyril Ramaphosa, he's a very suave negotiator. He's an accomplished anti-apartheid activist, trade union leader. He's obviously a skilled negotiator and strategist, and he was ANC's chief negotiator during South Africa's transition time. And so he, along with Rolf Meyer of the National Party, were the most involved in actual nuts and bolts negotiations to bring about what our present situation is. And therefore, for people to think that Cyril Ramaphosa is a solution, do not understand his history or background. And it's similar to the situation we've had in Zimbabwe where, yes, a tyrant has come down. And I suppose people dancing in the street is understandable when Mugabe fell. But his handpicked successor was the one who took his place. And similarly here, you've got also, while Zuma has fallen, Cyril Ramaphosa was one of his close associates, somebody who worked closely with him and was covering for him for most of his presidency while he was looting the country. And therefore, let's realize that our problem here is not a problem of a person. The problem here is not just Zuma. Just like in Zimbabwe, the main problem was not just Mugabe. The problem is the African National Congress. The middle letters of cancer is ANC. There are over 5 million reasons why I would not vote for the African National Congress. More than 1.4 million babies have been killed by abortion in South Africa, officially, legally, often with taxpayers' money, since Nelson Mandela legalized abortion demand 1 February 1997. So 1.4 million babies killed by abortion since the ANC legalized abortion on demand. In addition to that, we've got something in a region of 650,000 people have been murdered in South Africa since 1994 under the ANC government. Yet the ANC has steadfastly refused to consider reinstating the death penalty for murder, nor have they been willing to put the matter even to a referendum. In addition, we've had something in a region of 1.5 million women and children raped in the 23 years of ANC misrule, while pornography has been legalized, and reportedly less than 7% of reported rapes result in convictions. The ANC is soft on criminals and it's hard on the victims of crime. Rather than fight crime effectively, the ANC have worked to disarm potential victims of crime, denying firearms licenses to tens of thousands of law-abiding citizens, and claiming that self-defense is not a legitimate reason for owning a firearm. Rather than supporting community initiatives to fight crime, the ANC have consistently frustrated communities by demanding, for example, that security barriers be removed from crime-afflicted suburbs. The ANC's Ministry of Education also has evidenced a generally hostile attitude to Christianity, an insensitivity to concerns of parents, prejudice against the Bible. There's been a continual attempt to dumb down education and turn government schools into recruitment centers for radical homosexual groups. The ANC affirmative action, black economic empowerment, and blind support for Mugabe's racist, tyrannical policies chased away investors, cost the South African economy millions of jobs. For every year the ANC has been in power, the number of unemployed has increased by another million. Right now we have something close to 28 million people unemployed in this country. That's more than the total population of the country when Mandela became president in 1994. The ANC has been a catastrophe to our economy. Just in the first 10 years of ANC rule, our economy, according to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, shrunk by 30%. The rand on the ANC went from 2 rand to the dollar to 14 rand to the dollar. Rates and taxes are higher and government services are lower. Despite increased taxes and rates, the filthy, litter-strewn, graffiti-vandalized communities testify to the incompetence of government, where regularly electricity failures, and not only that, but even the turning off of water taps and the threat of even one of the 10th largest cities in the world, Cape Town, running out of water, is within sight. And they're talking about a day zero when the taps are switched off. Corruption has flourished under the ANC to such an extent that the ANC is referred in the streets as the Abortion, Nepotism and Corruption Party, ANC. Or as I call them, the cancer. The middle letters of cancer are ANC. A cancer does nothing to aid the health of the body. It breaks down the health of the body, breaks down the resistance of the body to disease. A cancer is something that corrodes and erodes and poisons and kills. And the scripture says they claim to know God, but by their actions they deny him. They are detestable, disobedient, and unfit for doing anything good. Titus 1:16. Another one of the millions of reasons why I wouldn't vote for the ANC ever is the endless propaganda and pornographic programs on the state TV, which is supported by compulsory licenses. You have to pay for these licenses. Well, I refuse to because I don't watch TV. And they still want to send us bills, but I'm not interested. I'm not watching their garbage. I wouldn't want to. I don't have a TV, and I'm only interested in watching selected videos that we may obtain, but we are not interested in watching the state propaganda. SATV is the voice of the ANC. The arrogance of so many in the ANC and the arbitrary manner in which they ride roughshod over the concerns and freedoms of others, such as the Minister of Health refusing to meet over 1,000 concerned doctors, and how their ICASA has attempted to close down many Christian community radio stations. There are so many reasons why we should be seriously critical of this new euphoria over a change in president. A change of leader in the ANC does not necessarily mean a change of policy. And I'm not sure what my friends are all excited about when I listened to what was said about the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, in his State of the Nation address last week. He was talking about compulsory confiscation of white-owned farms, and this received the longest, loudest applause from the House. Confiscation of white-owned farms and properties without compensation? Whatever happened to the Bill of Rights? What happened to private ownership of property? What happened to discernment from Christians who want to listen to this and then cheer it and say this offers hope for a new dawn in South Africa? The Bible instructs us, Exodus 18:21, select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials. Evidently, all ANC candidates failed to qualify on biblical grounds. They are not capable. They do not fear God. They are not trustworthy. They do not hate dishonest gain. Therefore, they're not qualified as officials. It is quite clear that what we are facing at this time is a concerted attempt to brainwash our people. We're seeing a criminalizing of a country. We're seeing a paganizing of a country. We're seeing such an increase, not only of crime and violence, but of a lack of respect for life and property to the extent that the president can be cheered and applauded in the House for wanting to take away farms without compensation. It reminds me of a joke in Zambia. I was visiting Zambia, and the people there mentioned that the South African ambassador was being introduced to the Zambian Minister of Naval Affairs. The South African ambassador said, "You can't have a Minister of Naval Affairs. Zambia is a landlocked country." And in response, the Zambian said, "Well, in South Africa, you have a Ministry of Justice." That isn't really much of a joke, because it seems quite inappropriate. In South Africa, we have a Ministry of Safety and Security. Well, crime and violence would be a more accurate description. A communication leaflet issued by the Southern Police Service to tourists contained the following safety hints for the holiday season. Never display jewelry, cameras, mobile phones, or valuables. Well, when should jewelry be worn if not in public? Are you meant to sleep with it or use it in the shower? What are tourists meant to do with the cameras and other valuables when walking the streets? SAPS safety hints to tourists include no less than 32 basic rules while on the streets or traveling or at hotels. But the extremely intrusive, inconvenient, frustrating requirements for safety in South Africa hardly seem excessive at all, because theft, assault, and murder, even of tourists, has become commonplace. And those of us who remember what things used to be like, those of us who remember when we didn't need steering locks, gear locks, car alarms, when these were unknown, when I know people who never even took the keys out of the ignition of the car even when parked downtown. Many homes were never locked, including mine. Burglar bars, security gates, home alarms, armed response companies were unknown and unnecessary. And now they talk about the born free and liberation. Many homes in the past didn't even have a wall, just a little low fence or hedge around the property. Children walked or cycled on their own to school with no fear for safety. What has happened to cause South Africa to generate to such a low respect for life and property? How has crime and corruption seeped through all sections of society? Well, it's quite clear that when justice is done, it must be seen to be done, and it must be seen to be done swiftly, and it must be done promptly. And this is what is not being done. When we have got presidents who can loot the country and not be brought to trial, when you can have, such as in the case of Zuma, with over 750 charges of corruption and a rape case against him, simply seize control of the ANC party, kick out the existing president, who wasn't a good man either, and then fire the attorney general and the prosecutor and abolish the FBI-trained scorpions who were investigating him. And then, would you believe it, the man he appointed as the new prosecuting authority dropped all the charges against him. Well, this is what is going on. So if people are wanting to know what is going on in South Africa at this time, how is it that we should respond, I think it's absolutely vital that we call our people to prayer, that we make a stand, that we study the book of Nehemiah, how to rebuild the walls. We need to be informed, we need to be interceding, and we need to be involved. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? There is so much that needs to be done. There's so much that we can do and that we must do. We need to be informed. We need to be interceding. We need to be involved. We need to be rebuilding the wall. I do believe there is hope. But we need to wake up, we need to humble ourselves, we need to pray, we need to seek God's face, and we need to turn from our wicked ways. We cannot expect God to forgive our sins, hear our prayers, or heal our land unless we humble ourselves, pray, seek God's face, and turn from his wicked ways. You will find more on these matters by turning to our frontlinemissionsa.org website. You'll also find on the new Henry Morton Stanley website, that's HMS Journalism website, you'll find a whole range of articles tackling these issues. And on the Christian Action website, we're regularly putting different challenges on what's going on in the country. You'll see audios, videos, PowerPoints on the different links, and also details about upcoming events, resources, Security and Survival Handbook has just been brought out. There's the Ten Commandments, God's Perfect Law for Liberty book, Biblical Principles for Africa, both in English and Afrikaans. There's resources available. There are tried and tested, battle-proven strategies that we can implement. Let's get informed. Let's inform the people around us. Let's get back involved, and let's reclaim South Africa for Christ. Good night, and God bless you.